Shrink Wrap Radio number 49, September 1st, 2006. The Psychology of Terrorism. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
When the government first faced the problem of terrorism, they turned to psychiatrists for assistance in trying to understand this new problem, and it's been a long road since then, but we've got quite a lot of evidence now, and we've studied quite a number of terrorists in lots of different groups and lots of different countries and continents, and it's now completely clear that the great majority of people who are involved in terrorism are psychiatrically normal.
That was the voice of psychologist Dr. Clark McCauley, who goes by the nickname Rick. We've never met in person, but I've been looking for a guest to interview about the psychology of terrorism, and Rick came highly recommended by my friend Jerry Trumbull, who knew Rick in graduate school. Dr. Rick McCauley is professor of psychology at Bryn Mawr College. He also has ties to my undergraduate alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, where he is director of the Solomon Asch Center for Ethno-Political Conflict. In addition, he is also co-director of the START Consortium. START is an acronym that stands for the Study of Terrorism and the Response to Terrorism. And I believe this group was recently awarded a $12 million grant by the Department of Homeland Security to study terrorism. He received his PhD in social psychology from the University of Pennsylvania in 1970. His research interests include stereotypes and the psychology of group identification, group dynamics, and intergroup conflict, and the psychological foundations of ethnic conflict and genocide. And he's edited a book called The Psychology of Ethnic and Cultural Conflict, and he's also authored one called Why Not Kill Them All? The Origins of Genocide. And you'll find references to this and other information about him in our show notes on the website at shrinkwrapradio.com. With no further ado, let's get into the interview. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Good. Now, let me start out by asking how you got into the study of terrorism in the first place.
Well, I have to go back a few years for that. Back in the 80s, I was a consultant reviewer to the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation of New York City. And their mission is to work on problems of human dominance, aggression, and violence. And in particular, they support a program of research aimed at these problems. And back in the 80s, the U.S. started becoming aware of problems of terrorism in a way that it hadn't before. And as a reviewer, I was reading lots of proposals to the foundation from scholars who, in one way or another, wanted to study problems of terrorism.
That's interesting that way back in the 80s, that's way before 9/11.
Yes, well, the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation is blessed with some very capable and far-seeing people as program officers. In any case, some very far-sighted program officers, and they early on were interested in this as a problem, obviously in the realm of dominance, aggression, and violence, and the result was that I was reading a lot of proposals, and then the foundation started sponsoring conferences with various scholars of terrorism attending the conferences. And out of that came indeed a book of reporting basically the upshot of a conference, of one particular conference that the Center Guggenheim Foundation had sponsored. And I was the editor of that. And before long, like most academics who think about almost anything for more than a few weeks, I began to think that I had something to say myself that might be of use, and in particular, my background was in small group dynamics, and so at the time, the commonplace assumption was that terrorists were crazy. That is, some kind of psychopathology problem was what made it possible for people to do horrific things, innocence. And my business was to try to persuade people back in those days that actually an intense form of small group dynamics was what moved perfectly normal people, people like you and me, to be capable of terrorism, and that psychopathology was not a very useful explanation. So that was my beginning of an interest in this area.
Yeah, you anticipated actually one of my questions, because I think there's probably still a pretty widespread belief that terrorists, for example, the suicide bombers, that they must be mentally disturbed to commit such acts, that they must be either crazy or they must be psychopaths. But you say the research suggests otherwise.
No, I think we're pretty clear now. Back in the 80s, it wasn't so clear. When the government first faced the problem of terrorism, they turned to psychiatrists for assistance in trying to understand this new problem. And it's been a long road since then, but we've got quite a lot of evidence now, and we've studied quite a number of terrorists in lots of different groups and lots of different countries and continents, and it's now completely clear that the great majority of people who are involved in terrorism are psychiatrically normal. Now, that's not to say that you won't every now and then find some individual with some kind of diagnosable disorder as a rare proposition, but it's no more common amongst people who are part of terrorist groups than it's true of people who are from similar background but are not terrorists. There's one notable study done of the Red Army faction, Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany, and they knew who the people were, who were the terrorists, but they had gone underground, so the government didn't know where they were, but they knew who they were. And so they were able to do a very thorough study. They went back and they looked at the prenatal records and the preschool records and the early school records and the high school records, and most of them had at least some university training there. Their university experience, they interviewed their childhood friends and their parents. They interviewed the people who had been their classmates or even roommates or boyfriends and girlfriends or whatever in university. And they did all this work not only for the people that had gone underground as terrorists, but they did it as well for a comparison group of people who were from the same background, same neighborhood, same gender, same age, so matched in as many ways as they could with the terrorists, one for one. And in this comparison group, were, of course, not terrorists. And so they're looking for differences. And the answer was, in brief, after a whole shelf of reports from this very long research, that basically there wasn't anything useful to be found in terms of personality or psychiatric distinctions to be drawn between the terrorists and the comparison group of non-terrorists.
Okay, well, that's very interesting, and I've heard of other studies that have come to the same conclusion.
I think it's the general wisdom now, yes.
Yeah, maybe we should take just a brief step back, and let me ask you how you define terrorism.
Ah, well, now, there's a question we could spend some hours on. There have been whole forests level the paper on which have been printed the contentions about this particular issue.
What's the headline?
So I'll tell you that I think it is, it's the simplest thing is to say that it's killing civilians for political purposes.
Okay, yeah.
But after I've phrased it that way, then I have to make a distinction, and I have to say, well, states are, of course, capable of terrorism, same as non-state groups are. That is to say, it's certainly true that states kill civilians for political reasons. As a matter of fact, I can recommend a book called Death by Government by Rudolf Rummel, in which he does a reasonable estimate of all the civilians killed by government in the 20th century, and it comes to something like 140 million. 140 million.
Wow. Yeah,
that's compared to, say, 40 million worth of combat casualties. That's people dying in uniform in wars of the 20th century. And by comparison, then, the problem of terrorism is, at least in mortality, considerably smaller. So his best estimate of terrorists, guerrilla war, all kinds of non-state political violence, if you add it all up, it comes to perhaps half a million in the 20th century. So if you wanted to just weigh where is the biggest problem of terrorism, it's terrorism by the state, terrorism by governments run by people like Mao Zedong or Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler. So the big killer, 140 million worth in the 20th century, is government, and a much smaller killer is these non-state groups attacking states for political reasons. That might be half a million.
Yeah, that really takes you into some political ground. And I've been looking at a paper that you sent me that you wrote called Jiu-Jitsu Politics, Terrorism and Response to Terrorism. And in there, you indicate that it's kind of a dance between the two parties, between the terrorists and between government. And you have four principles that you talk about in there. Maybe I could read each of those four principles and get you to expand a little bit on each one of them.
Glad to try.
Okay. The first one was, the psychology at the bottom of terrorism is the same psychology at the bottom of less extreme forms of political action. Group identification, that is, the capacity to care about what happens to a cause and the group associated with that cause. So what's that about? What are you
saying?
Well,
that's
there?
About a very mysterious thing when you stop to think about it. Almost all of us care about some very large group which is essentially faceless. That is to say, a group so large that we do not know and can never know even 1% of it. So if you care about an ethnic group, or if you care about your country as a group, as Americans care about America and other Americans, for instance, then it's really quite a mysterious thing that you care so much about what happens to this enormous and faceless group of people. It's perhaps easy to see why we can care about people who are close to us and that we know face-to-face. That means, you know, our friends and our family and our teammates. These are people that we know individually. But the amazing thing about caring about something as big as an ethnicity or a nation or a country or a religion is that we're caring about something so very abstract.
Mm-hmm.
It is, as one scholar put it, an imagined community, not one that we can ever actually encounter. And this is actually only a small part of some even wider mystery, because when you look around, you can see that human beings are capable of caring about all kinds of things in ways that go beyond the economic or self-interest value of those things. So
how would this apply to Al-Qaeda, for example?
Well, let me finish telling you the whole expanse in which of identification in which I want to set, if you don't mind. People, human beings, we care, for instance, about possessions in a way that goes far beyond their monetary value. Especially in America, you know, we tend to feel good if our cars are relatively new and shiny and in good working order, and we feel bad if something happens to it, it's in the shop, it's got a scratch, if something's not working right on it. We care about our pets, or as we sometimes say now, companion animals. We care about them as if they were people sometimes,
mm-hmm.
in fact,
right.
even often. We care about people that don't even exist, fictional characters. We can shed real tears for characters that we see on television or on the stage, or maybe just read about in a book like Tiny Tim. And we can care about people who really do exist, but whom we don't know at all, maybe like Princess Di, for instance, or some famous football character or actor or actress.
Mm-hmm.
So as you look around, what you notice is that what most economists and most evolutionary psychologists like to talk about as the origin of human caring, which is self-interest, you notice how very inadequate that is. That we care about all kinds of things and people, and even imaginary people, that have no economic incentive for us. They have no self-interest value, at least in a material and economic sense. And when it comes to caring about large groups, we can even care about groups who we're not a member of. So lots of Americans sent money to help people who suffered from the tsunami. Lots of Americans are concerned about what's happening to people who are dying in the Sudan or in Congo. These are people who are not in our country. They're not in our ethnic group. Nevertheless, we feel a concern about them that we're ready to put resources behind. So my general point is that human beings seem to be ready. I would even say eager and needful to pour themselves into caring about other in ways that cannot be accounted for in economic terms. In this whole large, broad expanse of caring, then, I want to locate, in particular, caring about political, national, ethnic, religious groups and causes. And that's what makes it possible to have the kinds of politics, and in particular, the kinds of intergroup hostilities and conflicts that we have in the world. It's because we care about what happens to a group. It's because we feel like what happens to that group is good or bad, and it makes us feel good or bad when something good or bad happens to a group we care about. And this is the way in which we become capable of putting resources, ourselves at risk, ourselves and our children, even in harm's way and in combat, in order to defend group causes that we think are at risk. It's all part of this psychology. At the bottom of it is this human capacity to care about these very large and faceless groups, which is in many ways a mystery that we can do it, but the fact that we do it seems pretty plain.
Okay, let me move on to your second major point in this paper, in which you say politics is competition and terrorist groups are in constant competition with governments, more moderate opposition groups, and often other terrorist groups for the pyramid of sympathizers on whom terrorists depend for silence, support, and recruits.
Well, at the bottom of this is the idea that a terrorist group is involved in politics. The terrorist group wants something. Usually it feels desperate about something. And it feels like its cause or its group, and basically every cause has a group associated with it, and every group is thought of, every political group that counts is thought of as a cause by some size and number of people. So I tend to go back and forth between cause and the group associated with it. But every terrorist group is feeling desperate about some political cause or some political group. And they feel like they're losing out to the power of the state. And it has to be said that in the last 100 years or so, the power of the state has grown enormously in the world. It reaches deeper into people's everyday lives than ever did before in many ways. So these are people, the terrorists, who feel like their cause is in desperate danger of extinction and that they have got to do something desperate to save it. And it's very seldom that you see a terrorist emerge, as you might say, full-blown without some prior history of less extreme forms of protest or contention. That is usually what you see is the slow development from a base of some kind of protest group or movement, and then out of that crystallizes a very small proportion who are willing to go all the way to terrorism to try to save their cause as they see it. So just to give you some sense of this, for instance, the Red Brigade, a terrorist group in Italy in the 70s, it condensed out of a very large movement for free mass transit in Milan. And in the course of the interaction between the state and the demonstrators and the protesters, there's this constant escalation of violence, the state breaking up demonstrations and using some violence to do it, and most of the people who had been participants thinking, well, this isn't worth it, I'm quitting, but a smaller proportion always saying, well, we're going to take this to the next level, we're not going to take this sitting down, this is wrong. And you get to see this long, slow escalation of conflict between the challenge group and the state, and at the end of that trajectory is a small group of people who will go underground against the government as terrorists. And you can see a similar transition right here in the U.S. As a matter of fact, we had our own protest group called the Students for a Democratic Society. They wanted to change government policy, and they wanted to change the way government worked. And they started off in their first meetings, coming, many of them, in jackets and ties with Bible under their arms. But in the course of contesting against the U.S. government, they were either ignored or put down in various ways. There was some escalation of violence, the police riot at the Chicago Convention is usually mentioned. And out of this, Students for a Democratic Society slowly over a period of time crystallized what became the Weather Underground, who actually used bombs and killed some people. So what you usually see in the genesis of terrorism is an escalating interaction between a particular group or cause and the government. Yes, it's a kind of a dance, a dynamic back and forth between the actions of the one and the actions of the other. And this is extremely important to recognize, because if we think of the terrorists as the problem out there, that all we got to do is understand them, then we're never going to really make headway against this problem, because it isn't just them out there as if they were living in a vacuum. This is politics. Politics is competition, and it's the dynamics of the competition between the state and some group that wants something out of the state, or wants the state to stop doing something, wants to change state policy some way. It's that dynamic and interaction over a period of time that produces terrorism. And so we have to understand that to get to understand terrorism, we have to understand this relationship between a state and a challenge group. It's not going to be sufficient to try to understand only them.
Right.
We have to understand us and our response to them as well.
Yeah, and this really, I think, begins to get into your third point, which says that terrorists count on the response of the state to mobilize those who sympathize with the goals of the terrorists. State response, to the extent that it hurts or outrages those less committed than the terrorists, does for the terrorists what they cannot do for themselves. This is jujitsu politics, using the enemy's strength to mobilize against the enemy. And certainly that's something that I've been struck by, is that for any group that wants to get out there and protest and raise a real ruckus, they can make maybe any government look and become more and more repressive.
Well, I don't know whether it's true of any government, but it's certainly a very strong principle of group dynamics that out-group threat leads to in-group cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that when somebody from outside your group or your cause does something bad to you and yours, then by this mechanism of identification that I was talking about earlier, a whole lot of people who weren't paying much attention before, didn't care much about the issue maybe before, are now made to care, and what they care is that we should all pull together and we should stand against these people who have done these terrible things to us. This is a dynamic that terrorists count on. Some of the more literate and theoretical terrorists, like Carlos Margiela, actually write it down in so many words that one of our goals in choosing attacks against the state is we want to so outrage the state and its representatives that they will do back to us. They will come after us in ways that will hit not just us, because they usually don't know where we are very well, but they're going to hit a whole lot of other people who are kind of generally sympathetic to our cause, but who have thus far not been mobilized to any action, who are not taking any risks, who maybe don't even believe that it's morally justified to kill civilians for this cause. So this is a mechanism that terrorists can count on, and you get to see how this worked in the war on terrorism if you read, for instance, a kind of an autobiographical statement by Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is, most people have probably heard, kind of the right-hand man and theoretician of Osama bin Laden. And Zawahiri had a series published in Arabic in a newspaper published out of London, and the general title of this series was Knights Under the Banner of the Prophet. And in it, he describes a whole lot of history of his efforts against the Egyptian government. He's from Egypt himself. And And in there, you can find him saying explicitly, in so many words, the following. I'm going to have a very close to exact quotation, but probably not quite. If the shrapnel of war strike their bodies, meaning Americans in particular, then they will face a difficult choice between withdrawing from Islamic countries or coming out from behind their stooges, by which he means the Western-leaning governments of Islamic countries, and attacking us, al-Qaeda, themselves. And if they do the second, we have jihad. So his idea was, if we can make the people of America begin to feel some of the violence, that they will respond in a way that will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Consider from his position, he and Osama bin Laden are at the head of what is actually a pretty small, even back in its best days, now gone by, but, you know, so it might be some thousands of dedicated people. But his aspiration is to restore a caliphate, a pan-Islamic caliphate, so that all the different nations, all the way from Morocco to Indonesia, that are predominantly Muslim, they would all join together in a common state or government on the plan of the old caliphates of the 700s. That's what he wants. He wants, in short, to lead 1 billion Muslims worldwide in jihad against the West. And at the time of 9/11, he was doing a pretty bad job. They had failed in the sense that Zawahiri had been basically run out of Egypt. Bin Laden had been run out of Saudi Arabia. They had tried to contest for power in their home countries, and they had failed.
Wouldn't you say, as a result of the strategy, that they're doing a lot better now?
Well, I'm coming around to that thought.
Okay.
So basically, his hope was that by attacking America directly, as he said, moving from the near enemy, that's the governments that he wants to replace in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, to move from the near enemy to the far enemy, that is the U.S., who he understands to be the power behind the powers that he thinks are oppressing him. If we do that, then we'll get America to do a lot more than just support the people in these governments we want to get rid of, in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, say, but we're going to get them to come after us themselves. Then we have jihad. So he was expecting, they were expecting us to come after them in Afghanistan. Every now and then you still hear somebody saying something like, well, if those guys had ever known that we were going to get up off our duff and come all the way to Afghanistan after them, they never would have done it. Well, that's nonsense. They invested serious resources to have a guy killed, Sheikh Massoud, who was the only remaining opposition leader to the Taliban in Afghanistan. They did this 2 or 3 days before 9/11. They did it because they expected us to arrive in Afghanistan, and they wanted to eliminate the main opposition leader around whom the U.S. might hope to bring Afghan support against them, the Taliban. So they expected us in Afghanistan, and then they expected they would get what the Russians got in Afghanistan, which was a long, drawn-out, horrific war with immense, brutal casualties to the Afghan population, and that this would rouse the Muslim world, same as it had roused the Muslim world against the Russians, and that this would help mobilize the 1 billion Muslims who, up to then, were pretty much ignoring it. Them and al-Qaeda. And unfortunately for them, the U.S. Army was a lot different proposition than the Russians, and so we had relatively few troops on the ground, and we had a lot of air power used instead, and probably, best estimates, it probably was only 2,000 or 3,000 of what we might call collateral damage casualties, that is, civilian Afghans killed by U.S. operations to get rid of the Taliban. So compared to the Russians, it really was a surgical precision strike, and it did not produce the enormous, long-drawn-out list of casualties and civilian deaths in Afghanistan that al-Qaeda was hoping for. So they were looking like a pretty bad proposition by the time we finished running the Taliban out of power in Afghanistan. But then, from his point of view, we moved on to Iraq. which has proved to be just the kind of hole that Al-Qaeda hoped that Afghanistan would be, a long, drawn-out conflict that draws Muslims from all over the world who see the U.S. presence in Iraq as confirmation of all the things that Bin Laden had been saying for years, that the U.S. was just trying to control the oil in the Middle East, that the U.S. would not let any strong nation emerge amongst the Muslim nations. So the U.S. going in and taking out Iraq seemed like a confirmation of many of Osama bin Laden's prognostications. And so the situation we have now is the situation that Zarhiri and bin Laden hoped to obtain in Afghanistan but failed. Now they have that situation, I regret to say, in Iraq.
Right.
And having said all that is not to say that it's an easy question now what to do now. So that is a very difficult question, which I'm ill-prepared to answer. But to just show you how this jiu-jitsu politics worked, they did get, in the end, the kind of reaction from the U.S. that made their mobilization job for them.
Yes, I would say so. Your fourth point here, and maybe you've been touching on it, is understanding terrorist behavior requires understanding the relationship between terrorist acts and state responses. These form a dynamic of violence and counterviolence that must be seen as a whole, as a pattern, in order to make progress against the terrorists. So that's kind of what you've been talking about, is this pattern of violence and counterviolence, and it can serve to escalate and evangelize the cause of the terrorists. You're reluctant to comment on the solution, but you know, I wonder if you have any ideas about, you know, what does a government do? What should a government do to respond?
Well, from where we are now, you mean?
Sure.
Well, I tried to say that I think this is a very difficult proposition. I agree with the people who say that today, if we just were to pull out and leave tomorrow, that this would leave a kind of a failed state, which is a very useful training ground and breeding ground for further terrorism. So it's dangerous to just pull out, cut and run immediately. Mm-hmm. Bad things will no doubt come from that. The future, continuing on the path we're on, also looks pretty bad. It doesn't seem like we're making progress, at least not progress of the speed that Americans have come to expect. That is, I don't think realistically that the American people are going to support another 10 years of American troops in Iraq at the level that we have now. But it's beginning to look like that's the kind of commitment that's going to be required to try to make something out of the line we're on now. So then that leaves, of course, the question, is there some third line? Is there something else we could be doing besides either running as fast as we can and leaving them to whatever happens on the one hand, or trying to persevere on what looks like an extremely long-term difficult prospect, which is where we are now. And yes, I think there ought to be some better than that third line, but as I'm not an expert in this, I'm not really ready to be committed out loud in front of you and your friends
okay.
to what I think that is.
Okay. I noticed that you said, you know, when I put the question to you, you said, you know, from where we are now, and what I take from that is that if this question had been put to you before we went into Iraq, you might have had some suggestions. Maybe along the lines of, I mean, as I hear you speak, it sounds like you make an effort to be somewhat empathetic to the terrorists in terms of saying these are not crazy people, these are not psychopaths, these are people with a grievance. So it raises the question, can their grievances be addressed and answered as a way of de-escalating? That's the question in my mind, at least.
Well, you know, you'd have to be quite careful about what grievances you were talking about satisfying in order to go down this road. But I hope you understand, as you put this question to me, it occurs to me that perhaps I should be more clear than I have. Yes, I do think that the people that we're worried about as terrorists are not crazy. I do also think that what they do in killing civilians is immoral. It's a terrible thing, it's no less terrible for them than it is for states to do the same kind of ugly thing to civilians, which happens, as I was suggesting, all too often also. So in suggesting that we need to understand how they see the world, I'm not saying that I agree with how they see the world. And I do think, though, that it's important to try to understand their perspective. You can't predict what people are likely to do. You can't predict the likely impact of your own actions on your enemy if you don't try to get yourself into his perspective.
Right.
So
right.
That's what I'm trying to do. And in trying to say that there is a dynamic going on between the state and the terrorists, I don't mean by that that the moral standing of the state is no more and no less than the moral standing of the terrorists. I am saying that if you want to understand the conflict, and in particular you want to try to do the best you can in choosing your actions in response to terrorism, that you got to look at it from this dynamic point of view, and that requires, to some degree, getting into the heads of the terrorists.
Okay, well,
this
that's
a different thing from trying to put a moral equivalence between our government and the terrorists. I do not wish to do that.
Right. Well, that's a great place for us to wrap this up. And, Rick, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure talking with you.
I hope you found this discussion of the psychology of terrorism with Dr. Clark McCauley to be informative. In preparation for this interview, Dr. McCauley sent me two articles, each of which was actually a book chapter. McCauley's chapter, which is titled Jiu-Jitsu Politics, Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, is found in the just-released book Collateral Damage, The Psychological Effects of America's War on Terrorism, which is edited by Kimmel and Stout. I'll put a link to this book in the show notes. Dr. McCauley's reference to jiu-jitsu politics strikes me as particularly apt, inasmuch as I've been a student of the martial arts in the past, having studied both judo and more recently Tai Chi. And in both judo and Tai Chi, there is this concept of using your opponent's weight and motion to defeat him. In other words, instead of resisting your opponent's force, you blend with it and then redirect it just enough to throw him off balance. This is a great metaphor for capturing an aspect of the dynamic interplay between terrorists and the state. As Dr. McCauley has so clearly described, acts of violence by the terrorists compel the state to violent acts of suppression. Inevitably, the state's violence will impact civilians who are not terrorists, but who may be somewhat sympathetic or may be on the fence. When these people see and or experience the violence of the state, however, there's a strong chance this will tip their sympathies toward the terrorist cause. Jiu-jitsu politics indeed. These dynamics are playing out even here in the U.S., which has a fairly large Muslim population. Dr. McCauley points out in his article that the action of a mere 19 Arab Muslims on 9/11 led to a backlash of fear and hostility toward all Muslims in the U.S. Though not on a large scale, there have been documented instances of hate crimes, including murder, beatings, arson, attacks on mosques, shootings, vehicular assaults, and verbal threats. These sorts of reactions would tend to have the psychological impact of alienating U.S. Muslims from U.S. policy. Moreover, the U.S. government imprisoned hundreds of Arab and Muslim males after 9/11. Without being publicly charged or tried, many were held without counsel and many were deported months or even years later for visa violations. According to McCauley, the result of these policies of discrimination, internment, and deportation is that planeloads of young men are returning to places like Pakistan with the news that the U.S. is no place for a Muslim. In the U.S., he says, a not-welcome sign has undermined Muslim cooperation with the anti-terrorist investigations. This situation has been further aggravated by the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Macaulay also notes that since 9/11, it's become very difficult, if not impossible, for adult males from Arab and Muslim countries to get visas to enter the U.S. The result is fewer students coming to study here, fewer professors, journalists, government, and NGO personnel visiting the U.S. for professional reasons. As Macaulay points out, these policies may increase security in the short term, but in the longer term, U.S. visa policy helps build the wall Al-Qaeda wants between Muslims and Americans. Jiu-jitsu politics indeed. As you heard in the interview, Dr. Macaulay was reluctant to suggest solutions to our dilemma in Iraq. Interestingly, though, he does offer some concrete suggestions in his chapter on jiu-jitsu politics. As a marketing research consultant myself, I find it fascinating that he recommends that we should conduct tracking polls in Iraq and other Muslim countries. He says polls in Muslim countries should assess attitude toward the terrorist group and moral judgment of terrorist acts. Similarly, these polls should assess attitude toward the U.S. and moral judgment of U.S. anti-terrorist policies. As focus groups and polls are used to pretest policy initiatives in the U.S., so focus groups and polls in Muslim countries could be used to pretest new anti-terrorist initiatives before the U.S. implements them. This is politics, according to Macaulay, and the U.S. expertise and political campaigns can be brought to bear. He has a few other suggestions as well, but it was this market research approach that caught my eye. In the commercial arena, we're nothing if not superior marketers. In the international political arena, however, we fail to bring this expertise to the fore. So what do you think? What sort of counter-jiu-jitsu moves, if any, should we be applying to the terrorists? I'd be interested in your thoughts.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, hear Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Remember, if you use the special checkout discount code of SHRINK3 at GoDaddy.com, you can get a domain name for only $6.95 for a whole year. Plus, there are other GoDaddy discounts you'll find on our website at ShrinkWrapRadio.com. Now, maybe you've wondered about those ad insertions at the beginning of our show. A few months back, we signed a contract with Podshow, a relatively new San Francisco-based company that's creating a network of podcasts. In exchange for their placing those ads at the beginning of the show and my brief endorsements of the GoDaddy promotion, Shrink Wrap Radio gets free hosting plus a monthly stipend based on the number of listeners, and that's helping to defray our costs. I'm really glad for this relationship because I'm not sure I'd be able to afford continuing with the show without it. So I hope you'll be tolerant of these brief messages. Some of you have taken advantage of the GoDaddy offer, and I appreciate that. I'm hoping that in the future, I'll have some control over what messages get inserted. The Shadow Falls drama that they're promoting is quite good if you're interested in radio-style dramas. I've listened to a few episodes myself, but I haven't been happy with the tone of their insertion. I don't feel it's a good fit with the tone I set for my show. I've expressed this to the folks at Podshow, and they assure me that eventually there will be more possibility for customization. I'd really like to know what your reaction to these insertions has been. I continue to follow new additions to our Frapper map with great interest. I think we have 7 new additions, and they are David in Manila, Philippines, John in Urbana, Ohio, Mauricio in Malmo, Sweden, Jose in Miami, Florida, Judy in Lawrence, Kansas, Tracy in San Mateo, California, and Yolanda in Perth, Australia. Don't forget you can win a free autographed copy of the book I co-authored, in which I profile the infamous Zodiac serial killer. All you have to do to enter is put yourself on our Frapper map by going to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. And at the end of the year, there'll be a drawing for the book. Also, drop me an email if you're at all interested in attending the workshop I'll be co-leading in just a couple of weeks in Tuscany, Italy, from September 18 to the 24th. So hurry, time's running out.
I'm Jack Ward from the Sonic Society podcast, and you're on the couch with Shrink Wrap Radio. Dr. Dave will be back in a moment.
And back I am. Please feel free to follow Jack Ward's example by clicking on the My Chingo logo on the shrinkwrapradio.com webpage and recording a nice transition or leaving other voice feedback. Or you can leave a voicemail on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod. And you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And we also have an evolving MySpace page at myspace.com/shrinkpod. Now on to some of the recent emails from listeners. First, we hear from listener Lloyd in Australia, who's written before and who we are always happy to hear from. And he writes, "Hey, I just listened to show number 44, and you requested reactions to your idea of a short daily show. Hate to be negative, but I think it's a bad idea. The world is full of sound bites that expound deep ideas in shallow ways designed not to exceed the short attention span of its audience." That's cute. "The world needs more depth, not more conciseness, especially when you're dealing with such complex ideas as Jungian psychology. I feel a minute show would do disservice to them. Enjoying your show as per usual. Nearly completely caught up now. Regards, Lloyd." Hey, Lloyd, thanks for that feedback. I think I only heard from one other listener on the issue of doing a daily show, and that person was supportive of the idea. So the votes in my vast email supply are one to one. However, I think I'm leaning your way, Lloyd. I think that to put together even a really short show on a daily basis would just stretch me too thin. I'm finding that one show a week is actually a lot of work, and don't really think I'm inclined to do another one. Then we got another email from a listener who I won't even give a first name because some of the material is so personal, but still I wanted to be able to share it. And so this person writes, "I just finished your interesting podcast about medication, number 46. I would like to relate my story as my choice goes against the advice given by the guest, but I still had a very positive outcome. I decided I was a depression sufferer at about age 22. I've been suffering heavy depression since my teenage years, but never put the label on it until my sister started medication. I was convinced that my depression was based on a chemical imbalance in my brain, as it never really had a cause I could locate and seemed independent of circumstance. I took my self-prognosis to my GP. I had made a list of my symptoms. My GP initially thought I had copied the list of symptoms from the internet, as they were so classical of major depression, in order to get the antidepressants. Of course, I had not, which she eventually realized after much suspicious questioning. She obediently gave me the drugs, Celexa, and I started taking them. To make a long story short, they instantly improved my depression and have been working ever since, 6 years later. I've been much happier and have had no side effects at all. I believe this proves my initial assessment correct, that there really was no major psychological problem that was causing the depression and that it was purely chemical. My mantra has become chemical problems cannot be solved by non-chemical solutions. Non-chemical problems cannot be solved by chemical solutions. Also, may I put in a vote for more personal stories? Your hypnotist story was hilarious." Well, thank you so much for that comment on the hypnotist story. I've done 3 shows in which I went to some pains to tell a personal story in what I hoped was a humorous way. And yours, I think, is the only feedback I've received. I need more encouragement, folks, if you want to hear more of those. I do have one or two more up my sleeve at least. And as for your mantra, chemical problems cannot be solved by non-chemical solutions, non-chemical problems cannot be solved by chemical solutions, that may be a little bit too simplistic because we know that external events can affect the chemistry of the brain, that thoughts can affect the chemistry of the brain, and that the chemistry of the brain can affect thoughts and mood. So it's a complex two-way street. I'm really happy that you did a successful self-diagnosis. And you're right, quite often, but not always, quite often, depression is triggered by, for example, a loss of some sort, some external event. And you kind of examined that for yourself and figured out that, in fact, there was no loss, there was no other external event to account for it. And so, indeed, a chemical imbalance seems to have been the right self-diagnosis, and I'm really glad that Celexa has worked for you. I know other cases where the depression has definitely been triggered by some kind of psychological event, and psychotherapy, in fact, provided relief. And there's a lot of evidence that psychotherapy is about as effective as antidepressants in, I would say, mild to moderate neurotic depression. And I'm saying neurotic to distinguish it from really extreme depression, such as you would find in bipolar disorder. So it can work either way. Certainly, I know of people who've taken lots of antidepressants and did not enjoy the success that you've enjoyed. And on the other hand, lots of people have benefited from them. So I wish there were a really simple solution, but each case has to be judged on its own merits. I got another nice note from Dave in the Philippines with an offer to help out with the MySpace page. And he writes, "Hi, Doc. Great podcasts. I was catching up on back issues, and on show number 38, you mentioned that, but for time, etc., you'd have a MySpace page for shrink wrap. I was at that site after the show finished and was unable to find a shrink wrap page. So if you're still in want of an assistant, I'd certainly be willing to take on running the site for a while. I'm not an expert at MySpace, but it seems pretty straightforward from what I've experienced in very recently building my own cyber presence there." And then he gives me a link to his page to take a look at, which I need to do. I think I forgot to do that. "Anyway, if you still want a hand, I'd love to help bring this wonderful undertaking of yours to as wide an audience as possible. Best wishes and continued success, David." David, thank you very much for that generous offer. I think after the show that you heard, I did have someone else come forward, April Fresh Goddess, and she did a lot of work on that page, but I haven't heard from her recently. There are some additional details that I could enlist you on, maybe if you're interested. And also, I have some work to do on my pod show site and could get you involved there. If you really have got some volunteer energy, I can always use it. Okay, that's it for the listener email. Don't forget, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Your emails are what keeps me going, so I'm looking forward to them. I mentioned pod show earlier, and they give you yet another way to access Shrink Wrap Radio. You can do so by going to shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com. The Podshow site has a number of features designed to help you subscribe to your favorite podcasts. There's even a place where you can leave your reviews of Shrink Wrap Radio, and I hope you'll leave some of the good comments you've sent to me by email there so that others might be attracted to the show. In fact, there's one such review there now from listener Leonie in Australia. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. And another from podcaster Robin Maiden of Insight Works. So I definitely thank you too for that. Please help us to grow our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. If you're in a MySpace group, how about posting a bulletin to your group recommending Shrink Wrap Radio or posting a message to your blog or website? And to wrap things up, thanks again to Dr. Rick McCauley for sharing his fascinating work on the psychology of terrorism. And by the way, you'll want to be sure to listen to next week's show, in which I interview noted author and workshop leader Bill O'Hanlon on his work with the incredible hypnotherapist, Dr. Milton Erickson. We close today's show with a piece of PodSafe music that we've played at least two times before. I can't think of anything more appropriate for a show on terrorism, though, than a song advocating for peace. It's called Spirit of Lennon, Peace by Brad Stanfield. To me, it's very reminiscent of John Lennon's Give Peace a Chance. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Everyone lives, everyone dies. Everyone loves, everyone cries. Round the world, we're all alike. So why is there war? Why do we fight? There's one sea, one sky, one earth, so you and I gotta learn to live together. When one hurts, when one needs, we all feel, we all bleed. Gotta learn to live together. Time, brother, stop dying. Isn't it time, mother, stop crying? Stop the fighting and the hate. We gotta make peace before it's too late. There's one sea, one sky, one earth, so you and I gotta learn to live together. Alright, when one hurts, when one needs, we all feel, we all bleed. Gotta learn to live together.